Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm-fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit christmastreesny.org.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network, where we, the ladies of Groundworks Inc., bring the culture to horticulture. So we're in our shipping container today with artist, gardener, and longtime friend Abby Zabar. Abby has just wrapped up a gallery exhibit of her drawings of botanicals, and she's here today to talk turkey. Bad Thanksgiving pun.
Post-Thanksgiving pun.
She's here to talk about her work and her life as an artist, designer, and a gardener in urban New York City. Welcome, Abby.
Thank you.
So a little bit of background. Let's note that Abby was a guest last March on our Siebert and Rice pottery show, and she is a pottery designer as well of orchid pots. Carmen, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit more?
Sure. If you are not familiar with Abby, she is an acclaimed artist, graphic, and garden designer, and the author of five books. Her first book was titled The Potted Herb, which was published in 1988, and it's one of my favorite books. I still have it. It's fantastic. It's kind of a classic.
It is definitely a classic.
And her landscape collages have been represented by Alan Stone and Bloom and Hellman, and the Flowers in the Great Hall of the Metropolitan Museum of Art series has been represented by Ursus Books and Prints and the Horticultural Society of New York. Her artwork has been shown at the Museum of Modern Art, the Cooper Hewitt Museum, the Parrish Museum in Watermill, New York, the International Paper Corporation, the Louvre, the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, and the Vigela Museum in Oslo, and is part of the permanent collection of the Mead Paper Corporation of America, the Brooklyn Museum, the Jewish Museum, the Hunt Institute for Botanical Documentation in Pittsburgh, PA, and the Smithsonian Museum. That's quite a broad group of institutions.
You're a busy lady, yeah.
Zabar's illustrated articles have appeared in Garden Design, Horticulture, Fine Gardening, Gourmet, and the New York Times, as well as in numerous esteemed British publications. Zabar is currently the program chairperson for the Manhattan chapter of the North American Rock Garden Society and a learning leader for PS 198. So Abby has had two exhibits this year, one at Wave Hill and one at a gallery, W.M. Brady Co. on East 80th Street. So here's some information from the Wave Hill exhibit. Abby Zabar exhibited a selection of drawings from her series Flowers in the Great Hall of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. For a decade, Zabar visited the Metropolitan Museum of Art on a weekly basis to draw the glorious arrangements on display in the Great Hall, struck each week by the inventive arrangements. Zabar's experience as a gardener and her innate knowledge of the flowers, fronds, and leaves before her allowed her to capture the arrangements with a sure and deft hand well before the museum opened its doors for the day. Working in situ and in pencil, the only implement allowed in the space, her drawings showcase the vibrancy, variety, and vitality of the displays as captured in one quick setting. The exercise was an important weekly practice.
So, Abby, let's talk about these met flowers, because you and I go way back to this exhibit. Tell us what it was like to be in the Great Hall before opening. And can you define the importance of weekly exercise as an artist and flower lover?
I had the ability to be there before they opened. I was given a pass as a vendor. And usually when I arrived, it was dark. Maybe there were one or two lights on. And when the guards saw which bouquet, there are four bouquets in four different niches. And when they saw which bouquet I was focusing on, they turned the spotlights on that bouquet. All the bouquets use the same foliage, but it was just my choice. I mean, there was also a bouquet in the center of the museum, and that was actually my favorite to draw. It was in the very center, and because the light came in through the skylight on that particular arrangement, it was a very chiaroscuro kind of light. It came very harsh. It was very direct, and it was in very accentuated, having that light come in on one side. So I tried to usually draw the center bouquet. That was my favorite one to draw.
Yeah. Can you describe, we did post some of the pictures that you sent us
yes.
on Facebook yeah. and Instagram. Can you describe your style as an artist?
Well, my style depends upon what I'm drawing often. I mean, I can work right. in several mediums. And because I was limited, I could not have anything liquid, of course, in the Great Hall. And I was using colored pencil. And it's a very, what I liked about it was it had to be done very quickly. I had less than an hour before the doors opened to the public. So it's a very immediate way of drawing. There are no second chances here, and it's kind of just my style. I used to work for a newspaper, for a daily newspaper. I was a staff artist, and we had a 5 o'clock deadline every day. So for production, and I liked that kind of experience of drawing very quickly, not being precious about what you drew, just getting it right, and just the next thing was to do the next drawing.
Yeah. Well, that's what I think is so apparent in your drawings, is that they are so alive, and the movement and the kind of lyrical quality, when you look, it's fleeting and quick, but at the same time, it forces you to pause and take a look, and that's the beauty of them for me.
Yeah, I wanted to add too, Abby, that one of the things that I thought about when I saw those Met drawings all those years ago was they felt controlled yet wild and exuberant. You know, like you framed them very carefully, but they were so emotional still.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what made them so great. And people don't realize how big those we call them bouquets, but they are massive arrangements, aren't they?
Yes.
They are very big.
Yes, they're the height of a person. And
yeah.
I love the fact that the bouquets themselves are ephemeral. I mean, they're not going to be there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And also, each day they change. And for me, I would plan to get there on the weekend and usually on a Sunday because I knew the arrangements were changed on Mondays. And I really wanted those arrangements to be full open, almost like the petals were falling already. That, to me, was the most exciting time to draw the arrangement.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
About when you had selected. And there was, the Met had the same florist for many years.
Yes, yes, Chris Giftos.
Yes, yeah. Yes. He came to the horticulture.
He came to our opening.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, to speak about that. He was a very gifted.
He was excellent.
Giftos.
Yeah.
He was
And the other thing that I love about Abby's work is that it's on colored paper often.
Well, it's actually on...
Not colored.
No,
but
it was actually, to start with, it was on cardboard, like the kind of cardboard you get from the Chinese laundry. And I remember one of my framers telling me, maybe, Abby, you can do this on something more archival.
Right.
So I then switched to museum board, which has the same gray ground. It's actually a very soft kind of board, and I love the way the colored pencil just goes into that board. It's a very sensual kind of experience just to put your pencil on that background.
Mm-hmm.
But also the ground of the museum is like limestone, so it was very appropriate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I also really love the kind of quick edges that you gave to each piece. It made it seem like an architectural drawing, in a sense.
It's a little framed pencil edge. Yeah.
Yeah, and because it's so amazing that you captured so much, because, as we said, the actual arrangements were so massive, and your drawings are small.
They're intimate. And that to me was the challenge, Carmen. Yeah. I mean, to do an important bouquet very intimately rather than doing it grand.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, the dichotomy is very interesting, you know, and the texture. Some of the feeling of it, it had this, it was very textural, you know, mm-hmm. and even though it was like, I guess you could describe it loose, right? You didn't see every petal. You didn't see, you know, you didn't see details. This is not a botanical.
That's why it's not a botanical drawing. I mean, there's a suggestion of what those drawings, of what those flowers in that drawing are. I mean, that was what I was going for. The feeling of forsythia, the feeling of like quince buds opening.
Right. And that's what was so interesting to me, too, is that it requires a level of observation mm-hmm. that you bring to it that mm-hmm. most artists don't, because of your gardening experience. You're not just an artist, but you're also a gardener. So you see plants in a pretty unique way.
So let's talk about your garden.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because your garden really has influenced you tremendously. Mm-hmm. Can you take us on a walk through your penthouse garden?
Yes. Well, the first thing is the unusual thing is you get off the elevator and you're in my garden. That is actually the entry to my garden, which it was one of the charms of this apartment when I first saw it. And so you walk down a little way and then you go through a gate, a wrought iron gate that has my initial A, and I gold leaf the A in it. And then you walk, and on the way to that, there are these urns, these terracotta urns from Mexico. Mm-hmm. They're not frost-free, but they, knock wood, have survived several winters. And each one of those urns is filled with a particular little leaf boxwood, and I like these small leaf boxwoods. I'm working with Kingsville, and I'm actually working now with Morris Midget when I can find it. And they're like these little top hats on these big urns.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that these small leaf boxwoods, they're not succumbing so far to boxwood blight.
Yeah.
And also, they do well on terraces from the wind point of view. So then you go, and I see this as my little boxwood hedge. It's these urns, these terracotta urns filled with little top knots of boxwood. And then you go through the gate and you come into this area that has a canopy of trees. The trees have formed the canopy because I don't want a fabric canopy. And right now I'm working with birch trees. And I actually never knew what it meant to say that something was fast growing, but I can't keep up with these birch trees.
Yeah.
I can see why they are soft wood, because they are so, they just grow.
I know.
Are they clipped? Are they pollarded or espaliered or, you know, trimmed in a particular manner?
I'm trying to. They are multi-trunked,
okay,
and they're heritage variety.
Okay.
So I am just trying to make a vase out of them to have the canopy. That is the only styling I'm doing of them.
So you're not making them touch?
They are by themselves.
Okay, but you're not forcing that?
No, but I don't even have to force it.
It's just happening.
No. It's just happening.
Yeah, we're asked to plant birches a lot on roofs, and we're just like, yes, they will someday outgrow their pots. Just giving you a heads up.
You have to want to like to prune.
Yeah.
You just do. I mean, it's, and yeah. I do.
I love to prune.
Yeah, I do too. And I mean, if someone doesn't want to prune, it's the wrong tree for them. It's not slow growing wood.
No.
Yeah.
It's not slow growing.
No,
it is. But you're growing it as much for the trunks, right? The heritage,
exactly.
The heritage is the river birch, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is fast growing, likes sun,
and it's got that dual color
and
of
the bark.
Brown and white.
Beautiful, beautiful.
And it peels young. It starts peeling
exactly
at a young age.
Yes.
You don't have to wait like a crepe myrtle many, many years to start seeing the...
No.
And they're spectacular in the winter,
yes.
Which is a very important part of New York.
Yes, exactly.
Because we have a long, ugly winter.
Right.
We do.
But they're multi-trunked. So actually, looking out at my terrace at this point, it almost looks like a grove of them. So and that is the effect I really wanted.
Yeah.
So, because that little area in the front where we've just come into, that is the most visual part of my garden from inside. And I look at it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So I want it to be attractive all the time, whether it's in leaf or whether it has snow.
Right. And you have a lot of other containerized plants.
I mean, so then we go left and we walk down alongside the solarium to the what I call the back 40. And it is the parapet of the building, which abuts another building. And in typical New York style, it's no view. I mean, the view there is of the brick wall of the other building. And on that, I have my whole rockery. So it's rockery are little tiny plants and fascinating habits of growth and fascinating blossoms. So you're actually not paying attention to the brick wall. You become very absorbed in this little minutia that's going on in front of you. And it's thrilling. I mean, it's a very intensive kind of gardening as opposed to the hang loose of the...
Highline and like the sweeping...
Yes.
And they're in, those are like in hyper tufa containers, right? Or other.
In all manner of
all
cloth.
Manner. Okay.
Anytime I see something that I think is going to be cool, I mean, it could be a brick, it could be a cobblestone.
Yeah.
Anything that I think this could work.
And they require maintenance. I mean, a fine kind of hand. They're not sort of low maintenance kind of gardens. They're sort of miniature worlds, right? Kind of.
They are, but they're hardy souls. I mean, they take care of themselves.
Because you have alpines and
yes,
so and you're high up, so you've got the.
I have
conditions.
An alpine condition.
Yeah.
In New York, which is what, like a half a mile above sea level, not
right.
even right.
Yeah. No, but once you're up in elevation and stories on a building, what floor are you on? I mean, it's the penthouse.
15. It's 15.
Right.
Wow, so the winds do howl up there, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, and they're very, you know, you're in certain areas are wind tunnels, so you can't predict until you're up there and growing something how it's going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess that's true anywhere. I mean,
yeah.
And what has surprised you, Abby, that has made it that you thought, well, I'm just going to try this and, you know, I don't care if it works or not. I hope it does, but...
Literally throwing caution to the wind.
Yeah, and said, you know, I want to try this.
Well, there are these group of plants called saxifrage in rock gardens. And everyone told me, you know, they are so fussy. I mean, they really just want the Alps. And they hate humidity. They can't stand the smog in the summertime. It's true. It's absolutely true, and I have killed them for years. But I have a collection of them now that's pretty terrific, so I'm pretty proud of that. But no one really focuses in on that. You know, it's just a quiet little thing.
Is that going to be your next book, Abby? Yeah.
No, because I actually don't even know how it happened.
Well, it's a great testing ground, though, that you're giving them, and...
It's fun to experiment with new things. Alice and I do that in our own gardens before we put new cultivars or things. We do little experiments in our own container gardens and in the ground to see how it works for a year in this zone.
And hardy gardenia does not work well in this zone. Everybody says by the book it's supposed to, but I can tell you it does not work in my front container garden.
No, it doesn't make it, no. Unfortunately.
Every year I try it, and I wrap it, and I do everything possible, but then I just buy a new one for the spring.
Yes, I would like not to treat perennials as annuals.
Yeah, I know. It's sometimes you have to, though. We're also so limited with space, you know. Yeah.
So your garden is not super floral, Abby. It's very green.
Green, right? Yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, for all of my drawing of flowers, I don't think of myself as a florific person. I like green.
I think of you as very minimalist and modern. Mm-hmm. That's in the palette and the kind of cleanliness in your spaces.
Mm-hmm. And you do also grow a lot of herbs as well, and topiary, right?
Yes.
Those
are all there. I mean, those are second nature, and they're not a big deal, you know,
right.
So I don't even, you know, they exist there.
Do you have to bring them in and out?
I do, but I leave the rosemary out pretty late.
Mine is out still. Hanging in this
absolutely.
Year.
Absolutely, it should be out it's still. I mean, it could go down to probably about 25 degrees without wind.
Yeah.
In a pot.
Yeah.
I have, I brought my papyrus into my house this year for the first time because I love it so much.
Yes.
That I said, I'm just going to try to grow it inside and see if it can take the drier.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? It's an aquatic. I put it in a giant Chinese bowl and it's just so beautiful. You know, the cold in a couple of weeks would have just devastated it. You know?
I just brought my jasmine in over the weekend. And I'm going to try and overwinter it in the house. We'll see.
You can. What is it? Which jasmine?
It's the Confederate.
Uh-huh.
So we'll see. You know, it just smells so heavenly.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can't just, if I cut it hard, it's not going to work. Because it's in kind of a small pot in the front of my house. So I thought, let me bring it in. Let me see. You know, maybe.
You had extraordinary plants in front of your house this year.
This was a good year.
Calocasias, those ruffled, the leaves were this big.
Oh,
I'm
my
sure
God.
You know them.
Yes.
And
They were probably 10 feet tall.
Yeah, and we donated them to one of Alice's neighbors who had a sunroom because it broke our heart to have to throw them out.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, it just, when you grow something along. And
it was Jurassic in my front garden this year.
Yeah.
Well, we have to take a break. Yeah. We're talking minutia and we're talking beautiful plants with Abby Zabar. Hang on, you're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, this is Harry Rosenblum, host of Feast Your Ears here on Heritage Radio Network. This is my first season as a host, but at the Brooklyn Kitchen, we've been supporting Heritage Radio for many years, and I really believe in what Heritage does. It is a fantastic network that really highlights everything that is going on in food in America, from restaurant openings to farms to my show, where I feature interesting people with interesting stories related to food. But Heritage is a not-for-profit. We don't make any money. Most of the hosts do this because we love to do it, and we really do need your help as listeners. We'd love to have you listen, whether you can give any money or not. The website will still be up. You can still stream your favorite shows. But if you do like the programs here on Heritage Radio, we really would encourage you to go to the website, heritageradionetwork.org, click on the beating heart in the upper right-hand corner, and give whatever you can. If you drink coffee every afternoon while you listen to shows on Heritage, then maybe you can give us the cost of a cup of coffee once in a while. If you want to become a larger member, there's all kinds of great things you get if you become a member of the station and a larger supporter. So please join me, join the Brooklyn Kitchen, join our other great sponsors, and become a member.
Transcends the miles.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State-grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arriving to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer. And trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm-fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. Today we're talking with Abby Zabar, longtime friend and artist, gardener. And we were just talking a lot about, before the break, about Abby's garden and kind of the very specific particulars that she really has excelled at, I think.
Refined.
And refined in her urban garden.
Polished.
Polished, exactly.
It's a polished garden.
It is. But it's not. It's not. It's not precious
no.
in that it's, you can feel your hand in it.
Yeah.
It's not.
And the great thing about it is that Abby actually does it herself.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a lot of people like to curate things, but they don't actually get dirty, don't actually do things.
No, when Abby takes on a project, it's all Abby's Zabar. From concept to execution to finished product. But when I first met Abby, I was invited over to her house, and we were working on the Hort Society show.
The Met flowers.
Show. Yeah. And I noticed that Abby had these gorgeous landscapes, and they're big. They're big visuals. Abby, can you kind of describe that? Because that work is very different than the flower drawings.
Those were collages, and they were paper collages that I did landscapes as paper collages, because I actually saw the landscape as collage. Whether I was in an airplane looking down, a small airplane looking down at the topography, or whether I was on the highway and I would just see the mountains and the clouds and the land, to me it just looked very collaged. Mm-hmm. And it's not collages in terms of a few cigarette wrappers and stuff like
right,
that.
Right. It's not magazine cutout.
No. It's working with paper as collage.
Uh-huh.
And I actually remember when I was applying to art school, I think it must have been Pratt, but I think I was also already doing collage in high school at Music and Art. And one of the things on the resume, one of the tasks, was to do a rendering in paint, or a colored rendering. And I was having a problem sending this in on time, and I remember I was making my mother very, very nervous, and she was like threatening me, like, if you don't finish this application this weekend, you're going to go to no college or something like that.
And so parental.
Yes, exactly. And so finally, I just, you know, figured, what the hell, I'll just do this in collage. And I remember doing the perspective in collage, and I remember the dean of the department wanting to meet this person, and I thought, oh my God, here it goes, you know, I'm not going to get in here.
Yeah.
And they were fascinated by, but it was the only medium that I could handle. I have never painted. I mean, even these floral drawings are not paint.
Right.
They are used in a painterly way, but I just can't work with paint. So these landscape collages are these swaths of color, and sometimes they're very barren. It could just be like a field on the North Fork, just with snow on it. And uh-huh. so it's like just, and it's these different pieces of white paper, including the white ground of the paper. And so it's like just white field of snow, and then a white of the ocean, and a different white layer of the clouds, and all these different whites happening in a winter scene.
Yeah, they're the most subtle but descriptive collage, landscape collages I've ever
seen. Oh, I want to see them.
I swear they haunt me. I think about them a lot.
Oh, thank you.
I never told you that.
I do, too. You know, you never did, Alice. I mean, you never did. But I actually think of them a lot because when I moved to the apartment I'm in now, it is so tiny. It was like there was a heartbreak moment because I knew I could never do those collages here again. So they were a moment in time.
They're in my brain forever.
Thank you.
So, I mean, seriously, like they have stayed with me, what, 15 years ago, I think I saw them?
Yeah.
So,
or more,
yeah.
Maybe if I really, you know, have a studio one day, although I really like the idea of working on the corner of a table somewhere.
Yeah.
That's not my style to have a real studio. I think I would be very intimidated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you could go, here's a sort of off-the-cuff question. If you could go to any museum or place to draw,
right,
where would you?
I feel, Carmen, I don't select my places. They select me.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, I can be seeing something and I feel, oh, that's very intriguing. I want to draw it right now. Where's my pen? Oh, I don't have the right paper. Oh, I have the back of this envelope, though, or the menu here is fine. And I am intimidated by having the proper pens, the proper paper. I feel, oh, my gosh, I have to do a really fine drawing at this point.
Right. Whereas if it's more improvised, you feel free.
Much more comfortable. Yeah. And then I can make excuses.
Well, those excuses got you into school and they got you like this amazing career. And you, what I love is that you have blended everything that you look at and touch has the Abby Zabar stamp to it. Literally, sometimes you have actually made stamps out of terracotta when you do your terracotta work.
Right.
So another thing that I always think about is many years ago, you did an article, and I don't remember which publication it was, but it was in kind of an overview of a service, a blessing of the animals service.
It was the Times.
It was the New York Times.
Right.
So can you describe that, because I remember the article, and I want our listeners to hear it from your words.
Yes, it was at a church on I think about 64th and Park Avenue, and I love the fact that the animals were going down the aisle, that was going to be what happened that day. And I was prepared. I actually came that day with a pad and pen and whatever. And I sat on the end of the aisle. And it's just a heartwarming thing. And to see these animals so well behaved. And, you know, it's almost like they're up for the event. And I remember passing some fancy looking dogs on the street, like, with, you know, pom-poms and stuff. And and I'm thinking, where are they going? And they wound up at that church. They were all decked out for it. So
they had their Sunday best on.
Oh, yes. And and I love the fact that they're all well behaved. You know, maybe there'll be a little bit of pee-pee in the aisle or something. But no animals are fighting each other. You know, there's no, you know, drama going on.
No.
That's interesting.
We always say in the dog park, it's not the animals that are ill-behaved. It's the people that are ill-behaved.
Right, and they probably pick up the vibration.
Yeah, the animals figure it out, and they...
So they were in the spirit of the moment and the place,
yes,
right?
Yes,
that's interesting.
Yes.
And so you wrote the article as well as illustrated it.
Yes, I did the illustrations very quickly there. I mean, because, you know, the animal... I was sitting in a pew seat, and they were all lined up here, and just as they passed, I would just do a quick drawing of each one.
Well, that's what I loved about it, is there was so much impression just from your quick line.
I remember the guy, the one dog with his paws out in the center, and everyone had to pass him, but like he was just perfectly okay sitting like that.
See, that's the thing about Abby, is you find the idiosyncratic, and you elevate it, and that's...
Well, it's to find what makes that what it is.
Unique.
You know, when you draw a peony, what makes that peony, that fluffy, outrageous flower, as opposed to some proper little, you know, something other flower, you know.
For example.
And it's to get the essence.
Yes.
I mean, to me, the essence of anything in life is the most important thing.
Yeah, and one of the drawings from the Brady Show and was the red. I posted the one with the red roses, but they're actually black.
Thank you, Carmen. Yeah. They are.
And I love I juxtaposed the black roses in the red vase with the white in the picture, because they represented such, you know, especially now, the changing of the seasons, dark and light. You know, Abby drew these red roses black because they're black.
Yes,
that
is true. And actually, I was not able to get it black enough with the colored pencils, and I actually used black ink on that. I mean, and I used it with just thumbprints of black ink because I don't know how to paint. So I just was putting my thumb there to get it even blacker.
Yeah. Wow. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's like...
It looked like velvet when I looked at it.
It was rich.
But those roses have that velvet feel.
That texture.
Those petals.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I also loved the, in that particular series, the hyacinth, right?
Yes.
Because it was, you really got the essence. Now, of course, I'm a plant person, so I know what a hyacinth looks like. But even a person who doesn't know, you just got that sort of feeling of it's about to burst, you know, that's what they feel like when you get them, you know, that they
aren't.
That's
right.
You know?
And just doing them over several days, I mean, they are bursting like crazy. You
fast.
Have to do it very fast, you know, because I get them in the market, I bring them inside, and instantly they're starting to open.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
While I draw them, you know. But I love that. And that's why I will always draw from life. I will never draw
from photographs.
When I worked at a newspaper, I often had to draw from a PR release of like a new toaster oven, you know. And
love to see those.
Yeah, that's fun.
You would make the best looking toaster oven.
Thank you.
Imaginable.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Someone was just talking about this at a Thanksgiving party I was at the other night, because he remembers when I worked there. So it was at a Fairchild publication called Home Furnishings Daily, and that was a trade newspaper that at that time was a daily every day for 5 days a week.
Wow.
Okay, yes. And because I was the lowest person on the, you know, chain there, and I was hired recently, I got the things like toaster ovens to draw, not the sofas from, you know, I don't know, some fancy producer of sofas.
I see.
But I love doing those mechanical things, the toaster ovens and like the mix masters and stuff like that. And the reporters would come in, they'd leave you the press release with the photograph on your desk, and by 5 you had to be finished. And this friend of mine at dinner was saying this, because he remembers this, that the reporters would go back and they'd say, you know, there's a style of images and press releases on Abby's desk, and she hasn't even started yet. When is she going to get it, you know?
Uh-huh.
And they'd say, don't worry, she's going to have it all done by 5 o'clock. And I felt I had to just wait for the pressure to build up. You know, you handed me this too early, it's before lunch.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. I would also imagine... I mean,
and you wanted your mom behind your back saying, right? Abby, if you don't do this, you're never going to go anywhere.
She is no longer behind my back. She is in me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking that your style would lend itself enormously to fashion. You know,
I was sitting around. No, I don't do fashion, but I was at Fairchild Public. They did Women's Wear Daily.
Right.
And so
right.
all of the surrounding, and this was a pool. It was a blessed time in my life. I mean, it'll never happen again because they don't use drawings in newspapers.
Right.
But here were like 32, 36 artists drawing every single day. The most incredible art school I ever went to.
Right.
I mean, really.
Yeah. Yeah,
for a discipline.
Yeah, well, because it's trial by fire. You just do it, sink or swim.
Yes.
And you just have
have time to redo.
And
you
to
don't
think
no.
about
no,
it.
No, to think, you know, to get precious or think, oh, I really like that. I don't think I'm handing that one in.
Right,
It just has to go.
Right.
Yeah.
That's very
What a different era, you know?
It was the best.
How old were you?
I was just out of, I don't know, it was... I'd say I was 20.
Wow.
20, yeah.
That's young.
Yeah, I was young.
Like, in that pressure, you know?
Well, when I found that this existed, that, and it's funny because I went for another interview, and I was telling this over the weekend and Thanksgiving dinner also. Simultaneous, I was offered a job by Massimo Vignelli. Do you know? I mean, probably the great, one of the great designers of the 20th century, industrial graphics, architecture. Okay. And he had interviewed me a while before that, and nothing happened. And then all of a sudden he called, and he was interested in my working for him as a designer. That was simultaneous with my going for an interview at Fairchild Publications. And both those came in at the same time. And I just had to make the decision of what I was going to do.
Wow.
And somehow the temptation of being able to draw every single day was just more dramatic for me.
Well, and I think of you as you are an artist. I think you chose the right path because I don't see you as an industrial designer.
I am a graphic designer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Massimo actually, he was a great graphic designer. Mm-hmm. His wife, Layla, did the architecture and the industrial design.
Okay.
But their whole over, I think, was design. And mm-hmm. that's what mine was. And that's why I can kind of say, if I'm interested in the idea that someone proposes, yeah, I think I could do that. You know, whether it's a logo, whether it's an urban terrace, you know, mm-hmm. if I'm interested, I think I could do it.
Yeah. Well, you actually also have a really good feeling of architecture. And your architectural drawings, although quick and sketchy, if I have to describe them, are spot on because of the detail. So
when Massimo first hired me, he hired me on a freelance basis, and he had an aerial view of a city like Poughkeepsie or Yonkers that was run down, and he said, "Could you do this for us, a pen and ink drawing of it?" And I said yes, and he said, so I think I did the drawing, and I brought it in to him. This was all a freelance. And he said, okay, this looks great. What do you charge? And I can't remember, but I told him the price. He said, this looks great. Now I'm going to tell you what you really should charge.
New York.
Abby, did you always know you wanted to be an artist from a young age?
Yes.
I had a feeling that was going to be the answer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Were you drawing all the time as a kid?
Yes.
Yeah.
And my mother, who was she didn't have a husband. Her husband had died. She was very concerned what was going to happen to her daughter, the artist. But she was always very good about finding, like, I was one of the first students who ever went to the Museum of Modern Art that no one remembers when they had an art school there.
Uh-huh.
And
wow.
Yeah. And she always found these
opportunities
for her daughter. Yes.
So she supported it.
Yes,
she really supported.
Yes. She just didn't know how I was going to make a living at it.
Right.
Every mother
and
worries.
Neither did
about,
I.
Right. Well, every mother seems to have that same worry. I have a good friend whose daughter wants to be a costume designer, and she was in the fashion business and has such a bitter taste in her mouth about it. She wasn't in the design. She was more in the manufacturing end, and she's really discouraging her daughter. And I said, her world and her vision is very different from yours, you know? So I'm sort of behind the scenes, sort of like, I'm going to take her to the Costume Institute. And, because I feel like if you already know at that young age what you want, Abby, I think that's brilliant and needs to be supported.
My mother-in-law, this was in the 50s, went to Radcliffe. And when she was there doing the interview, this is in the 50s, for applied mathematics, she knew she wanted to go for mathematics. And her mom came with her to the interview because it was with a man, and you can't be a young woman with a man in an interview. So they had the interview, and, you know, what books have you read? Just all the questions. And this was with the president of the school. And then the mother leaned over and she said, okay, this is all fine and good, but how are you going to teach my daughter about home economics? And the man said, ma'am, your daughter is talking about applied mathematics and robotics. I don't think reading a cookbook is going to be a problem for her. Mixing up a cake is going to be, like, she'll be fine. And she went on, and she was the first woman hired at IBM in the executive, position. So, there's a lot of things that moms have to just trust with their kids, I think. So let's go back to the idea of the student.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And kids.
And kids, because now you are giving it back.
Well, I'm a learning leader at a school on the Upper East Side, a public school, PS198. And I mean, at times I think I learn more from them than they learn from me. I have worked with the science teacher there. And a lot of these kids are tough kids. And to see them all of a sudden want to know what I'm doing with my plants there on the windowsill, it has become kind of like, oh, Miss Abby, can I work with you today? And because it's fun, it is not. It doesn't seem like what school is supposed to be about. And
it's not the core curriculum.
Exactly. And we're dealing with core all the time. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's the core on steroids, actually, because it's applied. You know, and that's what's
it's beyond the core.
That's what's been taken away from school, I think, is application. And
it's a wonderful thing to do. So you're sort of working with them with plants and horticulture, and give us an example of
I was supposed to be there just to help the teachers, because, and to me, really, I look at it that way, because these teachers need all the help hands that they can have. And so initially I was just very quiet and very laid back, because the room was sunny, I started bringing in the plants and stuff, and then I come in and I start cleaning up the plants, you know. But it's kind of fascinating, because each of these kids, the diversity of them is so phenomenal, and has their own little specialty. And like, let's say I see a kid who really likes cleaning the sink in the end, because we've jammed up the sink because all the leaves are going down it. But this one kid, he's very good with the sponge. He just loves it. You know, I don't know if he's going to be like, you know, the chief janitor in the world, you know?
Right.
But this is what and he was really out of control until he found himself at the sink, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, bless him. I mean, this is something he's really enjoying.
Right.
So it's
and
finding.
He feels useful.
Exactly.
Yeah. He finds himself useful, because maybe he's not comfortable necessarily in the academic environment. He needs a little diversity in his experience in the classroom,
right,
which is what you're bringing.
Well, that's what Abby brings to all of her work, actually, is she finds the thing, the essence of the thing, and articulates it. And that's really, I think, the essence of Abby, is you find these little gems that are often overlooked in the heyday and the rush, and you draw the animal with his crossed legs, and you draw the flower that's just bursting to be open and identified and looked at. And I just think of you walking through the city and observing. And
I feel in a way like when I'm drawing something on a sidewalk, I usually find a place that I'm sort of a little comfortable, or a wall that I'm leaning against, and I have a hood on and I kind of put the hood over me, and then I feel like I'm in my own world. I mean, I am drawing with this hood over me. People could be passing, you know, they could be like in a big argument, they could be hitting on me. It's like, you know, it's like I don't even hear you. I am just focused, and I love that.
That's a perfect way to end the show. Abby, thank you for being with us.
And tell our listeners where they can see
and purchase.
And purchase
some of the drawings are still available.
Yes, and I'll post more throughout the week. Because the gallery sent us a lot of great photos.
The gallery is called W.M. Brady. It's on the Upper East Side in Manhattan, and the address is 22 East 80th Street, and their phone number is 212-249-7212. Great.
So, Abby, thank you for all you do to promote gardening, and for looking at the world with quiet, observant eyes, and for teaching others to look and to do the same. You've created a wonderful, precious life that you articulate daily, which is inspiring. Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, dear friends.
And you've been listening to We Dig Plants. You can find us on Facebook. It's Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants, or on Twitter at pound We Dig Plants, on Instagram, Groundworks Gardens, New York City. Timber Press is going to be doing a weekly giveaway in December of books with us. Mm-hmm. So you have to become a member.
And you have to be our friend.
You have to be our friend or virtual friend in order to be entered into the drawing. So please do. And also, if you like this radio station, please become a member. It does the soul good, and it keeps the content coming. You just have to press the pulsing heart at the top of the webpage and share the love. So consider a membership for a friend. It makes a great holiday present. Thanks for listening.
Happy gardening.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.